Hello, friends. Welcome once again to the Perfect Bound Podcast. This is a podcast all about anything and everything comic books and comics related, brought to you by the Panel Jumper and the Comics Dungeon. My name is Ben. With me, as always, is Nicole Lamb.
Hello.
Chris Casso.
Hi.
And Cole Hornaday.
Hello, my fellow sailors on the seas of fate.
Can always count on Cole to make up something.
I'm not always. Hi, Chris. Hi. Hi.
How's everybody doing on this hot evening?
Well, Chris is feeling a little puny.
Puny?
Yeah.
What do you mean he's feeling puny?
This is new to Chris.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were sounding a little puny.
Ah, gotcha.
Okay.
Thank you. Now that we know context.
Yes. Context goes a long way.
Sorry. Sorry, Mr. Puny. I didn't mean to besmirch you, Mr. Puny. I apologize, Mr. Puny.
Oh, poking the bear.
Poking the bear.
He's wide awake now.
Anyway.
Well,
yes.
Hey, thank you all for coming out to the Central Cinema to see Odd Duck for Crackle Vision. We had a great time.
A marvelous time.
Really sorry to that person that I poked in the eye with a fork, but don't make fun of my movie. I'm joking. We had a great time. We had an awesome time. I don't know. This is weird.
It was a magical evening.
A magical evening. And please frequent the Central Cinema more. They're a great local place.
They are.
Let's talk about cartoons. Because, and I'll tell you why I want to talk about this. So, as we all know, The Killing Joke is coming out in animated form. Mm-hmm. And one of the biggest complaints that I've heard from people is that it is done in the art style of Batman the Animated Series, and it doesn't look like the Brian Bolland art from the book.
Right.
And because of this, somebody on the internet went through and recreated some scenes from the trailer to match Bolland's style a bit more. It looked pretty good. So my question was, are there any cartoon adaptations out there of comic books that adhere very closely to the art style of the book?
Yeah, there's actually quite more than I initially thought.
The only one I was thinking of was DC New Frontier,
which
I'm sure is on too. It's,
adapts Darwin Cook's style of art.
Yeah,
that one did a
pretty
good
looks
job.
Very much like Darwin Cook's graphic novel series.
The one that leaped first to mind for me was the MTV adaptation of Sam Keith's The Max.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
That's like panel for panel in the exact replica. And it's one of my favorite adaptations, partially because I love the voice acting on that show, too. And so the owner was here earlier with us, and he actually helped me figure out a bunch of others because I forgot about Persepolis the movie adaptation. Then Batman Year One, the animated one, does kind of look a bit like the David Mazzucchelli artwork. One of my other favorites is The Amazing Screw-On Head, which is an adaptation of Mike Mignola's.
I just didn't do any research for this one. And it's like,
well, actually, they were talking about this when I got here.
Okay, great. Yeah, because those are all really good examples.
This one's kind of obscure. There was a Kickstarter for it, and Michel Gagné's Saga of Rex, which is a series of short cartoons that are in the Flight anthologies, which are really good anthologies. They did do a Kickstarter to turn that into an animated piece, and it looked spot on. So those were some of the main ones.
Have you seen a lot of these?
I've read
the comic as well.
Yes. I haven't seen the final product for Saga of Rex. I don't even know if it got to its final stage yet. Persepolis, I haven't seen. Yeah, I haven't seen that.
Persepolis is Our Lady's Book Club. I don't know what date this is coming out.
You know, I actually recently heard that, I don't remember Satrapi pronouncing it as such, but people from Iran actually pronounce it Persepolis. But I wonder if that's not a dialect thing, depending on what part of the country you're from. I don't remember Satrapi when I interviewed her years ago pronouncing it that way, but someone else who was from Iran did pronounce it that way. So, Persepolis.
Anyway, the reason I ask if you've seen those is because I was wondering if watching the cartoon is akin to reading the book. Like, is it shot for shot? Is it, you know, the same, like, art style, yes, of course, but is it like seeing the book come alive?
For the Max, it was kind of an interesting one because when I rewatched that recently, it's almost stop motion-like, which reminds me of, like, the 60s, 70s Marvel cartoons that are, like, very much just, like, freeze frames that have, like, Iron Man going like this.
Yeah, the camera moves around the still image, but there'll be aspects about this very still image that are moving.
Yeah,
I forgot how good that was.
A lot of the others, like I think like Batman Year One, it's stuck pretty close to, but it does its own camera angles, so like stylistically it looks right, but it views differently than the movie in my head. That happens when I'm reading. I think Amazing Screw-On Head added things that weren't in the book. I can't quite remember.
But they're both awesome, really matter.
Yeah. a lot of it for me is the voice acting, because that's where I'm always interested to see how... pardon me. Somebody in
see?
A studio...
Puny. See? Puny.
Somebody in the studio thought a voice should be versus what I cast in my own head, versus like what is cast in our head because we saw it at a young age. Because Batman, in my head, sounds like the animated Batman. Same with Joker, you know.
So Kevin Conroy and Mark Hamill are your voices when you read a Batman comic?
Generally, so yeah. Wolverine kind of has.
That weird Australian dialect he had.
You're thinking from the Pride of the X-Men.
Yes.
Yeah, but in the 90s, he had a different voice. Yeah. So that's the one that's kind of in my head most of the time. Rogue's voice is the annoying one from the 90s cartoon as well. And Gambit's is very annoying all the time in my head.
It's because they lean heavily on these very cliched dialects.
Yeah. And
she has this southern drawl, and he has this really jotty Cajun, whatever he's trying to do.
The Max I never had a voice going for it, and so the cartoon gifted me with a great voice.
I was a big fan of the Max in the early days, and within the first couple of issues, you could mail order a cassette radio play of the Max, which I wish I still had. I sold it years ago. I'm sure it's worth bank now. But the guy that did the voice on that radio, and it was an audio adaptation of at least the first six issues of the Max. He sounds exactly, as I recall, as the same voice artist that did the animated series.
Oh. Crap, you know. Talked like this, and grumbly and growly and kind of mucusy.
Sounds great.
You
should do the voice, Cole Hornaday.
Sure.
And like every time I read a Transformers comic, Optimus Prime is Optimus Prime.
Yeah.
You know, so some of those get preset at a young age.
Optimus Prime is Eeyore. Yes. The same voice actor. Anyway,
they should redo a bunch of episodes with pure Eeyore voice.
I'm sorry, Megatron.
Yeah. Oh, that would be great.
Never mind.
Speaking of voice, I just a quick aside. The guy who does the voice of Winnie the Pooh, whose name I can't remember,
Sterling Holloway.
I saw a YouTube video. He was talking about all the voices that he did, and he was going through them, and somebody asked him to do Ka from the Jungle Book, and he's like, "Don't ask me to do Ka. He's just an evil poo." And if you remember the old Jungle Book comic or cartoon, Ka is an evil version of Winnie the Pooh.
Trust in me.
You know what's a weird
just
thing that just
trust in me
that just came across my mind because I see all the Suicide Squad displayed here. Mm. The Harley Quinn in my head is the animated. Voice.
Yeah.
Yep.
When you read current Harley Quinn, there's a huge dissonance. It doesn't match. You know.
Yeah,
so sometimes
it's not the same Harley.
Well,
it's
there's
why.
No sweetness to her anymore.
Yeah. Exactly. So
yeah, and they really did make her like a Deadpool. I mean, she just feels like a different Harley.
That's marvelous.
Yeah. I don't know if I'll ever have Ryan Reynolds in my head.
I think that's for the best. So I guess my concern is now the Killing Joke animated film has not been released yet, correct?
Next week.
It's soon.
It's getting one night only. Do we know, is it playing in town anywhere? for that one night only?
I'm pretty sure our coworker is going to go see it.
I guess what concerns me is the choice to stylistically shift it to the style of the animated series. I know they made a big to-do about casting Kevin Conroy as Batman in The Killing Joke and Mark Hamill as the Joker, but tonally...
It's very different.
Yeah,
but
gee,
they're probably trying to appeal to a demographic for nostalgia.
Sure.
You know, the moment you said Kevin Conroy, a flock of your demographic appeared a little bit quicker than it might not have. So some of those systems are purely marketing.
Yeah, and they already have that system in place to produce those cartoons, right? They know those animators, those artists can produce that comic, you know. You would to do. I'm just assuming that to do a Brian Bolland The Killing Joke cartoon would take a lot longer because that's a lot more animators that need to learn how to draw in that style.
Yeah, you'd have to reteach a whole production line in Korea to do something differently, or something like that.
Yeah. You know? So, anyway. All right. Cool. And that actually we kind of went on to another topic of what. Who do we hear in our head when we read comics, which I think is fascinating. Maybe we'll revisit that later. Because I love getting ideas for future.
Yeah, give us some time to research our favorite voice artists who we don't always know those performers' names, but on occasion there are folks where you go, oh, that guy.
Yeah. It's easier for me to hear a voice if I know it firsthand. Like if I'm reading Transformers, I know what all the characters sound like. You know, if I'm reading a new title, I haven't made another pop culture iteration of it. I probably wouldn't have a voice in it in my head. Mm-hmm. So, anyway, that's just me. Hey guys, let's move on to. our next topic of today, and I want to talk about comics and music. So we've talked about music representation of comics before.
We're all shifting for our notes here.
I know, I like that. We've talked about Gem and the Holograms, of course, and how they represent like the songs in the books. But I want to talk about what other comics are there that either are like biographies of musicians or portray bands on the run, as the case may be. what else is out there? Anybody?
Well, they did. There is a book called The Fifth Beatle.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that's something that is a biography.
Is it about Brian Epstein?
Yeah. I thought I reviewed it a while back. It's that's the one I was going to...
Or Pete Best, because either one of
those. No, it's Brian Epstein. It's a lovely book. It's written by Vivek J. Tiwari and drawn by Andrew Robinson and Kyle Baker. And it tells... it goes into the backstory of what Epstein's life was like, being gay, being a Jew, and then fronting or helping to manage, you know, the most popular band in the universe. I think it's a fascinating story. And it's a beautifully drawn book.
And then you get weird things like Archie meets Kiss.
Yes.
Because Kiss has to put himself
or the Kiss
in
comics
I
from
say
the
him
70s.
Because I'm talking about
Archie
you.
Meets Ramones is on the way, I think.
Yeah.
On the way, so it's been announced, but it's not been released yet.
Or even offered.
Yeah. And there's like another Josie and the Pussycats, which is not a real band, but is a real band, but not. But
see, is the Josie and the Pussycats getting the afterlife with Archie, Sabrina? I want to have a grim and gritty Josie and the Pussycats.
I think this is like
bummer.
Mark Wade kind of Archie,
Josie
like,
the
you know,
okay.
No, reimagined, like more modern.
Okay, you know. well, but if Wade's writing it, that could be interesting.
Well, I don't know if he's writing it. I'm just talking about
stylistically the making it.
As long as he doesn't try to do a Strange Fruit thing with it, we'll be fine.
I'm just talking about.
What do you have there, Chris?
I have.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Allergies. The hip hop Family Tree by Ed Piskor. And Fantagraphics published that. They're a local publisher. And basically, there's three volumes in an ongoing series right now. And he divided it up by years. And he... Four volumes. And basically, he's just going over all the different... hip-hop and rap artists over the ages. Mm-hmm. And he does it in this great kind of style that, like, all the covers look like 70s Marvel Comics covers. Mm-hmm. And they kind of have, like, this old newsprint kind of printing quality. And it's just a total history comic, which gives you the bibliography, the discography?
Discography.
Discography.
I can't say words.
Discography.
And the funky index with all the words here.
Persepolis. Thank you.
And yeah, so this is actually a really great resource too. And
it's a lovely. Really, it's like an awesome book.
Put together too.
And the fourth volume, I believe, is the what was coming out fairly monthly in single issue floppy form, and then they finally collected it. But the first few, I think, were just straight up graphic novels.
And that just came out like a week or two ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's pretty.
Unless we not forget one of my favorites, which is David Lasky and Frank Young's The Carter Family. Don't forget this song.
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
Which comes with a CD in the back, right?
Uh-huh.
Which I didn't know about, yeah, until the live show.
How could? Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought it was. That was one of those things I was always harping on about with where that book is concerned. Did you get a disc inside? It's so cool.
For those of you just tuning in, David Lasky was actually our guest at the Panel Jumper Live show.
Chapter 2.
Back in May.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
What do any other comics come with CDs that you can listen along with?
You know, I can't. I'm not sure, but I think the Jimi Hendrix graphic novel that Bill Sienkiewicz mm-hmm. did, I thought that came with a CD.
I missed that one entirely.
Yeah.
Do you remember the old Marvel things that came out with that would come with a record?
The Power Records.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That was a whole
yeah, I had a bunch of those.
James Kolchaka, who's a very interesting indie comic creator, also released a number of CDs. And I think like one or two of them came with his books. He also does a series of like children's books, like Johnny Boo and The Dragon Puncher. Mm-hmm. But he also does some like very creepy things as well. So he had CDs. I can't recall any others really that came with any music.
I do remember having these old magazine records. I think one was like a whale song, mm-hmm. and it came with a National Geographic.
Mm-hmm. The vinyl floppy.
Yeah. And as a kid, I just loved playing with it.
Yeah, those are great.
Didn't really care for the whale song, but it's a cool use of the medium.
World Magazine, Ranger Rick, those kinds of things. They all had those tipped in, those vinyl floppies.
John Muth, I think it was
John J. Muth.
He did an adaptation of
M, Fritz Lang's M. That had, and it was a score that he wrote, and I have that.
Yes,
that's right. But so I can't play it on anything because it is one of those vinyl tipped in. it was a 4-issue. They re-released the entire. It was a 4-part, perfect bound series.
Ding! No. Bell goes off every time we mention the name of the show.
Do I get a cookie or anything?
Sure, I'll get it later.
But I never did listen to it because I never had access to a turntable when it came out. They have reprinted it the series in the last couple of years in a single hardbound edition with no soundtrack.
Oh no!
Yeah.
Oh, that's a bummer.
Okay, I don't think I might have that. I'll see if I could find it and lend it to you.
Okay.
Because I thought there was a release. I have some other John J. Muth, like Sounds of Muth or something like
right.
that.
He was quite brilliant, and he's just kind of gone off the grid. I think he did a couple of children's books, and now I don't think he's doing comics anymore. Because when I picked up the M, I found it used a couple of years ago. And I was curious what, because he did a series in the 80s with J.M. DeMatteis called Moonshadow, that was watercolor and acrylic and pen and ink, and it's a very dreamy, surreal story about this boy being abducted by aliens and going to live in space and stuff like that. Do you guys remember that series at all?
Okay. Yeah. It's always in the quarter right? bins.
Yeah, it is always in the quarter bins, and it's unfortunate because it was a beautiful book.
And then for like fiction things, I mean, Scott Pilgrim fits into that because he's in a band.
Oh,
and Dazzler.
Oh, hey. Yeah, that's right. How can we forget the Disco Dazzler?
I believe there's another kid's book called Zebrafish, and I think that's a bunch of kids and a band as well.
Phonogram and Wicked and Divine.
Music is magic, Phonogram.
Yeah. Well, in Wicked and Divine, the new pantheon of gods are basically all the pop stars, so Beyonce is a god.
Yep.
Goddess.
Oh, really? Basically. Well, she's our queen. It only makes sense that she's a god as well.
There was also a really interesting series called 27 by Charles Soule, who's really popular these days. He's doing
everything.
Ton of everything, yeah. And that one was basically about the idea that all the a certain amount of great artists, of musicians, died at the age of 27. Mm-hmm.
Jimi Hendrix, Kurt Cobain, Janis Joplin. Ooh. Who am I missing?
Jim? Jim Morrison?
Mm-hmm.
Did he die?
Jim Morrison? Oh yeah,
I think so.
As well.
Yeah.
Well, that's 4. That's enough.
Yeah. There you go. I can't remember. There was like some conspiracy to it in his book, but I think that's
did Courtney Love kill every one of those?
Easy now.
That's not something that I think is
true. There is a Kurt Cobain comic coming out.
There is.
Yeah.
Is it conspiracy ridden?
It sounds like, yeah.
Is it from even a remotely reputable publisher?
Actually, kind of, yeah.
I think so.
IDW.
It's just, you know, why?
Is it a conspiracy comic?
We can't remember the solicitation. There's just a big picture of him.
I thought I remember it being something along, like that documentary that came out about the PI guy that was like working for Courtney Love and then became like a conspiracy theorist about her and everything. I think it's based off of something like that, around that, but yeah.
Well, there were the Rockography comics that were really cheaply produced back in the 90s, and they ground those out like confetti, and they had, but they were really, really sloppily produced, illustrated. Do you remember these? Do you remember what they were called?
Rockology.
I think you might be right. Anyway, they were everywhere because they were easy sales because, you know, they would be about every pop star under the sun, and you know, the shops where I was frequenting would order plenty and sell them all quickly because, you know, someone would come into the store that not necessarily was interested in comics or genre comics, but gosh darn it, they wanted to get a book on Sammy Hagar.
Yeah.
So the book is called Who Killed Kurt Cobain? The Story of Boda? Buddha? Is that what he calls it? Forget.
Boda?
It's his imaginary friend. So it is a work of fiction, and it recounts real-life events from Cobain's life as narrated by his childhood imaginary friend. So that's what it's about.
Interesting.
And it's the writer-artist is Nicholas Otero. Hmm.
So Boda is supposed to be Cobain's imaginary friend from childhood?
Yeah, and so it's recounting, I guess, real-life events, but told through this imaginary friend.
Kurt Cobain was my generation's was my generation's John Lennon.
Yeah, I mean, my husband saw that and just because like he is like Gen X.
Yeah,
you know, for real. So yeah, he was over at the moment he saw the picture.
Yeah, I gotta say, I'm not too anxious to read it. Anyway, since everybody's connected and all pieces of media are easily accessible, I'm actually surprised that CDs come in comics, because you can totally just listen to whatever you want to listen to online.
Oh, I do want to note something, because you did talk about in the show notes about like multimedia, using multimedia in comics.
Yeah.
Is that part of this?
Yeah.
So Bee and Puppycat did something really cool. Bee and Puppycat is an animated series that came out with a comic through Kaboom, I believe. And
so it was animated first?
It was animated first, okay. And then they do that, like Adventure Time has their own, Clarence has their own, et cetera, et cetera. And what you could do was they did a QR code. Mm-hmm. Like every time these characters would go to a different musical box and open it up, there would be a QR code that you could scan, and it would go to YouTube, and it would play a story, or play like a little song, like a music box. And even one of them went to just like a really long fart.
Because it was the broken one.
Because it was, it was broken and it had noxious fumes around it and stuff. But that, I thought, was a really cool idea.
Yeah.
I don't see that very often in comics, but I thought, you know, all the kids have the smartphones now too. So
I know, it's
weird,
crazy.
Strange little kids with, iPhones, but it was a neat idea.
Yeah, it's totally neat. And with advances in AR technology these days, it's just a matter of time until you take your iPhone, you put it over the panel on your comic book,
That's already happening.
Marvel has AR in their books where there's a little tag and you go over it. And then there's been a couple comics, like giant hardcovers that make that a big deal. That's like half the project is that they made a bunch of moving animations that went over the panel. There was that new sci-fi one from Image that Leanne really liked.
Faster Than Light?
Faster Than Light. That was a big selling point on it.
I think it had like tentacle monsters. Or whatever, yeah.
Okay, that is cool.
Yeah.
And then there was another really interesting QR thing. Oh, Valiant had a bunch of covers that's a painted face of the character, and then if you put your phone over the mouth, the little mouth would appear on your phone and start talking to you from the character's voice.
Wow.
And it would have like three or four things to say.
Wow.
So they're doing little things like that, and some of them are really, really cool and inventive.
That's pretty neat.
It makes paper important,
too. So you can have your own digital phone clutch cargo?
Yeah.
Wow. That's awesome. I wanna experience that. Anyway, that's great. Let's move on to book report, everybody. And this week, Cole, let's start with you. What did you read?
Well, I read DC's Scooby Apocalypse, which is part of DC's new sub
Hanna-Barbera for their adults.
Their sub, what do I want to call it?
Dark Barbera. Sub department.
They're Dark Barbera.
Their imprint.
Yeah, their new imprint. Thank you. That was the word I was looking for. Chris reviewed
Future Quest,
which I read a couple days ago and thought was fun.
They're fun.
But the most lovely thing about that is the 8 pages of Steve Rude artwork you get. So Scooby Apocalypse. This is interesting. It's not bad. It's just not very good.
I believe when you got here today, Cole, Scott, the owner, was here, and he asked you what you thought of it. And what did you tell him?
He said, he just pointed to the book and he said one word, and I said, meh.
And he replied, that's probably the best review you've heard.
Yeah. It's Keith Giffen does the plot and the breakdowns. I've always appreciated Giffen. He's not always a consistent writer. J.M. DeMatteis does the dialogue, and J.M. DeMatteis is one of my favorite, comic book navel-gazing superhero storytellers. So, he's written some of the best navel-gazing superhero stories of the 90s. The Martian Manhunter that's J.M. DeMatteis.
What does navel-gazing mean?
Just contemplating spirituality, contemplating the universe,
looking inward
to the point where you come out the other side.
You're looking down at your belly button?
Ruthlessly meditative.
Okay, got it.
Yeah,
got it.
You've never heard the term navel-gazing before?
No.
Read a book.
I do. They're called picture books.
It's not obvious what it means.
That's all right. And it's drawn by Howard Porter. So this is this is an opportunity that I think that these folks here at DC kind of missed because, with a title like Scooby Apocalypse, you're kind of getting set up like, is it going to be Ghostbusters fun? Is it going to be Lovecraftian horror, speckled with our beloved characters from childhood?
Is it Afterlife with Scooby?
Is it Afterlife with Scooby, which is precisely where I was going next. Thank you for reading my mind, Ben Lawrence. because we know that writers, comic book writers, can be inspired to tell those kind of stories with these beloved characters. Velma and Shaggy and Daphne and Fred, they're all cast in these modern contexts, but they waste a lot of time giving you their backstories. And, in 1969, when the original Scooby-Doo came out, one of the things that was fascinating about those characters and all the Hanna-Barbera characters is that they never bother with that stuff. Yep. It was right into the action. Yep. It was right into the goofiness.
Like, why was Speedbug an anthropomorphic car? How did he get
Didn't
his
matter.
Voice?
Who
Didn't
cares? Matter. Exactly. Let's go have fun.
Okay. I have a question about this, and it's a very important question. Is Scrappy-Doo in it?
Oh.
That could happen in all eventuality. And when you're dealing with a cybernetic, militarized Scooby-Doo and the dog whispering, hipster Shaggy, anything is possible.
Just looking for a simple yes or no, dude.
You're not going to get that. How long have you known me?
I want him to show up and them to go, quick, it's a bomb, and then toss him.
Cross the streams.
Yes.
Yeah, that would be great.
And then he's like, no, I'm not.
Yeah. And, I was reading this.
I'm so obnoxious.
I was reading this trying to find some type of connection to nostalgia and something that will compel me to read the book. And I got none of that, sadly. You've read this story before. There's nothing inspired or groundbreaking about it. And it's too bad because I think there's a great potential to do some really funky things with it. The last, the story of the first issue doesn't even take up the whole first issue. You've got a backup story telling the backstory of Shaggy and Scooby. But the last page of the primary story ends on a bunch of monsters that essentially swiped from our our beloved Universal monsters. There's Wolfman, there's King Kong, and there's Creature from the Black Lagoon.
But one of them is really Old Man Jenkins, right?
Oh, you know, and that's, see, yeah, no. Oh. No, he's not there because we don't get that, we don't get that little button on the end of this story.
It's, and there's, there are actually monsters, right?
There are monsters. It's, because it's the apocalypse.
Well, see, the interesting thing about the Scooby-Doo cartoon was that there were two sort of phases, right? There was the original cartoon, and all the monsters were just old dudes wearing masks who wanted kids to stay out of
the... I could have gotten away with it, too, for your lousy kids!
But if you remember, this in the Scrappy-Doo era, when it was just Daphne and Shaggy and Scooby and Scrappy,
right.
The monsters were real, and I thought that was a strange departure from the world that they'd set up.
I just like that we could say Scooby Phase 1, Scooby Phase 2.
Sorry. Yeah. And I was getting... Well, I'm looking at, you know, my old saw, it's always the source material. And then I was like looking at Wikipedia going, you know, there have been 12 Scooby-Doo TV series and over 30 animated films. So that old saw of mine is really, really pointless. So
what if the monsters take off their masks and there's more monsters under there?
That would be intriguing.
Monsterception?
Yes, it's Monsterception. That's the apocalypse.
What if he takes off his mask and he's an old dude?
What I was reading here was not inspiring to me, and that's unfortunate because there's a lot of great source material out there to pull from. I was thinking, you know, I've been reading the Fortean Times for over 30 years, and there are creepy oddball stories in those that you could plug into a Scooby-Doo context regardless of what period you're pulling the Scooby-Doo story from. I guess that, once again, you know, Afterlife with Archie has spoiled my expectations, and Scooby Apocalypse... Meh. Okay.
So, yes, go ahead.
Oh, old man takes off his mask and he's a monster.
That's actually what I meant to say. Okay.
Yes,
I got it backwards.
No,
what I really want now is if, like, the Frankenstein takes off his mask and he's a Dracula and he's just like, I just wanted to do something different.
Yeah, see, you know? There you go. Yeah. All right.
Yes, and?
I think the lesson we're learning here today is if you want to read Scooby Apocalypse, read Afterlife with Archie instead.
Or Sabrina.
Or just Sabrina. Come to us and we'll write a script for you.
All right. Thanks, Cole. Chris, yes. What about you?
So much rebirth, so little time. I'll do Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps. Rebirth, number one, which is not actual number one. It's like number zero. It's by Venditti and Vince Skiver. And Venditti, I like a lot of his work over at Valiant. I didn't like a lot of his new 52 work, but I think there's some shenanigans going in editorial there. And Van Sciver, I do really like his stuff when it's Green Lantern attached, because he makes cool aliens. And this is basically them cleaning up from the last year of New 52, where Hal Jordan was on the run, and he got rid of the ring, but he had a power gauntlet that harnessed the green energy of the rings. And he basically was like the universe's number one war criminal or something. And he basically took, like, all the blame for everything bad that ever happened to the Corps, even though nobody deserved to. And he's becoming, like, a creature of pure energy again. And he has to, like, will himself into existence. And it's basically a lot of recap. It's kind of telling you where all the different Lantern characters are. Sinestro has War World, which is, like, taken the place of Oa and is at the center of the universe now. And the Sinestro Corps is in charge of peace and order in the universe through fear. And it does actually a pretty good job of setting up, like, the next chapter. And it looks great. And what's interesting for me is it hits a really neat, like, a little piece of mythology I actually like being added, which is Hal Jordan is the only person that's not one of, like, the Guardians of the Gatling universe to
don't mix up your publishers, dude. That's a cardinal sin there, brother.
He it forged his own ring out of sheer willpower.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's going to be the one to remake the Green Lantern Corps. So he's like the new torchbearer. I like that as an idea. So there's a lot of really good potential there. I don't think Van Sciver is going to be the regular artist. He never is. But it is a very good, just like, this is what our focus will be for the next
until the year next or reboot.
Until the next reboot.
Yeah.
But it looks great. was fun. Not much happened.
So I'm sorry. I was fiddling with my phone. No parallax, no yellow flaw.
Parallax is still a part of the story. Mm-hmm. I bet you he's still part of like the lantern that Hal just forged or something.
Okay.
Parallax is actually the power battery to Warworld, which is what Sinestro controls everything from. And they're gonna. It looks like they're gonna do some interesting stuff with Parallax. So I like all the Sinestro stuff. That's one of the new 52 titles I actually really liked throughout the run because it seemed to run separate from New 52 continuity. It didn't, but it read like it did because it was well written. And I just like Sinestro because he's a very well-textured villain with interesting background history that makes you kind of like, you know, you're still horrible, but I get why you do what you did. So yeah, it's actually pretty good start point.
Cool. Excellent. All right. Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps. Is that the official title or is it just Green Lantern?
It's Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps.
Mm-hmm. All righty.
There is a Green Lanterns series as well.
Which focuses on Earth. This is the space title.
Gotcha.
That's what I tend to prefer.
Cool. Thanks, Chris. Nicole, what about you?
I read Black Masks, Kim and Kim. And there's a lot of people with hyphen names. The writer is Mags Visaggio. And Pencils and Inks is Ava Cabrera and a whole bunch of other wonderful people doing colors and letters and edits and all kinds of things. Katie Rex is actually she's an editor and she's a Valkyrie. So there's a bunch of Valkyries working for Black Mask. Valkyries are women who work in comic book shops. We're a network of females.
I know those things.
If you listen to the Perfect Bound podcast, it was like the first, issue one.
Yes, issue one. So in case you're just tuning in.
Well, you were looking at me like, you need to be educated.
It's all about you, Cole. Yes.
Oh, thank goodness.
Yeah, I know. Such a relief. Such a relief.
It's nice to get that validation.
Yes, keep going. I'm sorry.
So it's got really cute art style, which I dig. It's got really vibrant colors. I love it. It's two bounty hunters who are not able to get paying gigs. They got shafted out of their first one. They find out that there's like this really big bounty. So they start going after this guy who seems to have tentacles and is kind of evil. And one of the Kims is a trans woman and she mentions it in here. And she has a falling out with her father who I guess also runs this big bounty hunting place. And she's like, well, I'm not going to go and work for him. Like I won't do that because, you know, we're at odds and whatever. But it's a lot of fun and there's some great action in it. There's some interesting characters. It's all space. It's all sci-fi, but it doesn't always feel that way. It's like you're on a planet and they're talking about like the planet doesn't always look like this, just so you know. Like there's just interesting tidbits like that, just like, by the way, it's not all like that. It's like, okay. They're cute characters and it's totally my kind of jam. I'm really excited for a lot of stuff that Black Mask is coming out with this year. I wish it would be faster. But I'm very glad that Kim and Kim is one of the earlier ones and I'm really curious to keep reading it and see how it goes. It was a really good first issue. Established a lot of things about the characters and also gave you, you know, something to hold on to as far as plot. So, yeah, I really enjoyed it.
I like the cover art, too.
Yeah, it's beautiful. That cover art is by... Who is it by? Tess Fowler. Mm. Who is
Do I know her?
Well, I'm excited because she's Rat Queen's girl. Right. But I don't know if she's going to be much anymore. But anyway, I like her. She's a great artist.
All right.
Yeah.
Cool. Kim and Kim. Thanks, Nicole. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, that's Book Report, and that's our show. And coming up is quiz time. But before we go, I want to tell you that the Perfect Bound podcast is brought to you by The Panel Jumper. See everything Cole Hornaday and I do at thepaneljumper.com. And by The Comics Dungeon here at 319 Northeast 45th Street in beautiful downtown Wallingford. You can see the beautiful store behind us here. There's more over there you can't see. Or 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at comicsdungeon.com. Send us an email. Do we get anything wrong? Do you want us to talk about something? Tell us, validate Cole because he likes that, at perfectboundpodcast@gmail.com. Or you can subscribe to us at perfectboundpodcast.com on iTunes or however you get your podcasts. And there are a lot of ways to get podcasts these days.
Yeah, you can ingest them. You can, you know, take them,
shoot them right into your brain. Right. All right.
Oh, man, that would make
soon enough,
so
in a couple of years.
Indeed.
Easier. They're now, highly contagious.
Now it's quiz time. And today, get your quiz hats on, everybody. And today, our questions are coming to us from Mr. Cole Hornaday. Lay it on us, Cole.
So the title of this week's quiz time is Just Say the Word. These questions are tied to the theme of superheroes and the transformational language upon which they rely. So, obviously, there's going to be some gimmies here. Mm-hmm. And Chris, mm-hmm. I love you, but please let me finish a freaking sentence. Firstly, when young Billy Batson utters this phrase, magical lightning from the gods transforms him into that big red cheese Captain Marvel. What is the magic word? Why, yes, Chris, you're right. It is Shazam. Now, as you know, Shazam is an acronym for the names of five gods. Can you name those five gods, dear brother Chris?
Let's see. Samson.
Mm-hmm.
Hercules.
Mm-hmm.
Atlas.
Mm-hmm.
Zeus.
Mm-hmm.
Hermes. Feet.
Aragorn.
Heel.
Achilles.
There you go.
S is the last Shazam.
M.
I'm tired.
It is late.
Mercury. Yep, you got it. Thank you. Captain Marvel was originally published by Fawcett Comics from 1939 to 1953, and then as Shazam at DC Comics from 1972 to the present. Thank you for letting me be a jerk to you. I always appreciate that. In the 1950s, a small British publisher, L. Miller & Son, began publishing a very thinly veiled copy of Captain Marvel called Marvel Man, later renamed Miracle Man thanks to the objections of on the part of Marvel Comics' legal department. What was the magic word freelance reporter Mike Moran uttered to make his miraculous transformation?
Kamota.
Excellent. Kamota only spelled with a K. It's supposed to be atomic spelled backwards, and that just never made any sense to me. Alan Moore's successful reboot of this character began in UK's Warrior magazine in 1982. It led to an ongoing series from Eclipse Comics in 1985 that was ultimately penned by Neil Gaiman. Following Eclipse's filing for bankruptcy in 1994, Todd McFarlane got his clutches on the character, and it turned into a big legal mess, and there's not enough air in this comic book story.
That character had a lot of big names behind it.
Yeah. He bought the whole stock of characters from Eclipse, assuming that Miracle Man was part of the package, and that character belonged to him, and he incorporated that character along with the Heap and all those other characters into his Spawnverse. He was wrong. Neil Gaiman took him to court over it and won.
Awesome. All right.
So DC's John L. Thunder possesses a genie-like creature known as a Thunderbolt, though his friends call him Iz, that resides inside his magic ink pen. What was the phrase Johnny Thunder utters to free his magically electrified pal?
Say you.
Excellent. Say you. Or actually,
say me.
Or
say forever.
But it's spelled, but it's actually like
C-I-E-U or
right,
something like
right.
that.
Johnny Thunder first appeared in Flash Comics number one in 1940. Now, in the 1975, Filmation paired its own original live-action female-centered superhero TV series with Shazam in its Saturday morning lineup. What was the phrase high school science teacher Andrea Thomas uttered upon lifting the Tutmoose amulet from within her blouse?
Isis?
Almighty Isis.
Mighty Isis.
Yeah, I love that show. She was so hot.
Yeah, well,
yeah. The Secrets of Isis ran on Saturday morning from 1975 to 1977 and began its syndication in 1978 and will run ad nauseum until the goddess sees fit to return to this dimension.
You can find it on YouTube.
No, I want the goddess to come back to our dimension. And finally, once upon a time, in the land of Camelot, Merlin the Magician bound a demon to a loyal knight of the Round Table, rendering that knight immortal, but eternally cursed. What was the phrase demonologist Jason Blood utters to swap places with his damned counterpart?
Gone, gone, form of man, something, something, Etrigan.
Rise the demon, Etrigan.
Yes,
wow.
That's what I said.
The demon was created by Jack Kirby for DC Comics in 1972 when sales for his Fourth World books hit the fan and did not make the numbers the publisher had anticipated, and that is quiz time. Thank you.
By the power of Grayskull, Cole, thank you very much.
You're very, very welcome.
All right, well, that's quiz time.
Cringer.
That's our show. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next week.